It's been a year since the global pandemic was declared, a year which has been almost the most trying for billions around the world. And while there is hope that the end of the COVID nightmare may be in sight with vaccines having been rolled out, the economic turmoil caused by the virus in so many countries is a reminder that a genuine return to our pre-pandemic lives is still some distance away. So what is the state of the world economy? The International Monetary Fund has just released its World Economic Outlook. Joining us now, the chief economist, Geeta Gopinath. Geeta, great having you on this program. The IMF projects India to grow at 12.5% this year, 6.9% next year. Was this assessment made before the second wave of COVID struck India?
Hi, Vishnu. It's a pleasure to join you. Indeed, these numbers were locked in, I believe, around March 5th. So they do precede the recent surge in virus cases. But at the same time, I should mention that when we were making our assessments, we did assume that local containment measures would be in place, because as long as you don't get to some form of widespread vaccination, the risk of future waves are always there. So we have some sort of local containment measures assumed in our forecast. We certainly don't have any kind of a national lockdown. So if there's something much more stricter than that, then that would, of course, pose a downside risk to our forecast.
So, Geeta, is there therefore any estimate on how the progression of the virus in India during the second wave so far will hit India economically, because the numbers are surging at almost world record levels over a period of 24 hours or so?
So, Vision, I don't have a number for you. I think it's still preliminary at this point to make an assessment. I would just mention that even in the previous wave of these virus cases, when it was quite high, we started seeing something of a disconnect between economic activity and the virus cases. So, you know, in India, like in many other countries of the world, we've seen economic activity adapt to living with the pandemic. And so we have to keep in mind when we make economic projections. But I don't have a number for you right now.
So how does a nation like India balance the need to protect jobs and run the economy while needing to protect lives, which some people would suggest is best done by going into a lockdown? It's a contradiction in a sense.
This is a very difficult trade-off. There's no doubt about it. When you put countries in lockdown, it has a direct hit on economic activity, on people's livelihoods. But at the same time, there is the gain that you might Now, I think the world has gotten better in terms of, you know, what kind of containment measures to put in place. Again, contact tracing, testing, widespread testing is very important. And also, of course, to keep in mind that, I mean, lockdowns are not vaccinations. All the lockdowns buy you is time to actually get the right work done, which is to get widespread vaccinations. And that's where the focus should be in India right now.
Now, you've said in the report that greater progress with vaccinations can uplift the forecast, while new virus variants that evade vaccines can lead to a sharp downgrade. How concerned are you, given the strains that we are seeing, that global economic growth will in fact be very badly hit going forward by the South African, Brazilian, or even the UK strain, which is now spread?
So what we do know is, especially with regards to the UK strain, and even the South African strain and the Brazilian strain, that at least when it comes to very serious illness and hospitalization, the vaccines are highly effective. Mm. So, you know, the vaccines are still working. Again, there are more and more mutations happening on a daily basis, and we track what the scientists say on this front. But at least so far, we haven't heard of anything that says that, you know, at least in terms of protecting lives, that the vaccines will not be effective.
You write that vaccine access is also deeply iniquitous with certain countries getting the lion's share, right? 16% of the world's population having pre-purchased 50% of the doses. Now, India has been seen to be the pharmacy of the world, and we have this incredible manufacturing capacity. But at the moment, India has stopped exporting vaccines to meet our domestic requirements. Is that problematic?
It's a challenge for all countries. You know, we are seeing the desire to vaccinate your own people first before you export. I mean, on that front, I would actually say that India has demonstrated quite a leadership role in exporting vaccines to over 77 countries. So it's quite the exception in this regard, not many other examples of this. But again, I think that I would just broadly step back and say that for the world as a whole, of course, we have to just ramp up production and countries will have to work together because this is, you know, vaccine production has a very big global supply chain. And the last thing you want is where one country prevents export of one input and then the other country retaliates. And that would just make everybody worse off. The good news is that if you look at the vaccine production numbers, they are expected to ramp up quite considerably in the second quarter and then in the third quarter. And I think that will help in getting much more widespread availability. The second piece, of course, is the point you made about the highly inequitous access. There are many countries that have multiples of what they will need to protect their populations. And I think this is the time for them to start committing to transferring those excess doses out in an equitable manner.
Now, the report says that close to 95 million more people are estimated to have fallen below the threshold of extreme poverty in 2020 compared with pre-pandemic projections, reversing a two-decade-long trend of global poverty reduction. Which parts of the world have seen the sharpest drop towards poverty? Are we likely to see some other areas drop down below that poverty level as well?
So that's our estimate for the millions that entered, likely to have entered extreme poverty in 2020, which just comes from a big hit to per capita income, is a 95 million. I mean, of that, 50 million is in India. So, you know, the vast majority of that number comes from the hit to per capita incomes in India in 2020. About 25 million comes from sub-Saharan Africa, and then 25 million comes from other countries. So, you know, these are very difficult times for many people in the world. Employment levels are nowhere near where they should be. And, you know, people are being hit very hard in terms of just basic income.
Now, it's interesting that you should mention that a large part of that fall to poverty comes from India. And my next question is related. Does the IMF share concerns about the possibility of reverse migration of labor again in India if there are more lockdowns? Given the numbers, that is a possibility. Lockdowns, as you know, caused incredible hardships in the past for migrants. Do you believe that if India were to confront that situation again, it would be better handled?
I think this time around, you know, a lot more attention has to be paid to what kind of lockdown you put in place. Something much more localized, more targeted, ensuring, of course, that migrant workers don't have to walk hundreds of kilometers to return home, of course, is something that you want to prevent from happening. A lot has been learned. I think the health system is much better prepared, even in India, to deal with COVID. So this is not exactly the same as what it was in the first round when, of course, it caught everybody by surprise. So again, I think all measures are needed. And in this regard, I would also mention that, I mean, this is a point I have been making, which is that, you know, we see an argument for India to do some more on the revenue expenditure front. So, you know, a lot of the income support measures and the in-kind measures that were extended kind of expired in November last year. And it was, you know, one of the points I made was that it would be good to extend it. So I think I'm back here making that same point, which is that extending those kinds of income support measures would be extremely important, just given the uncertainty and, of course, given what we're seeing right now. That would be really essential to maintain livelihoods.
Just to press you on the point that you were mentioning about a substantial percentage of India accounting for the global shift to poverty, obviously, it's a big country, big numbers. Doesn't that sort of contradict what you had initially predicted earlier on in March, that, you know, the Indian economy in 2020, 2021 would grow very substantially? So are you suggesting that that growth is just top line growth or just growth in certain segments of the economy, whereas poverty would be a very real reality we need to contend with?
Vishen, I don't think there's anything inconsistent here because, I mean, the last time The numbers we had was for India were minus 8.8% growth in 2020 and then 11.5% in 2021. Right now, we've increased it by a small amount to 12.5%. The important thing, of course, is to add, kind of look at the aggregate effect, because if you've had a very sizable contraction, then of course I think it's very good that India has returned to positive year-on-year growth. But again, this is still a long ways to go. So let me just to put some numbers in perspective. If you look, for instance, at India's per capita income over 2020 to 2022, kind of on average, the hit to per capita income is about 9% relative to what it would have been in the absence of this pandemic. And so, again, we are seeing recoveries. It's good news that there is recoveries and stabilization. Of course, there are risks right now in terms of the virus. But still, there is a distance to travel.
So just one more India question before we look at a couple of other important themes. Rising inflation in India, lower growth. How and when do you think India will be able to come out of this situation, just looking at the state of India's economy presently?
Well, again, if our numbers, which are our baseline forecasts, hold up, then India should continue to recover. We, in our projections, we do see India having a medium-term hit, which means relative to where it would have been in the absence of the pandemic. For instance, by 2025, India pre-pandemic was projected to reach about 4.8 trillion, become a $4.8 trillion economy. Mm-hmm. And right now the projection is 4.2 trillion in 2025. So again, there is some distance to go, but the good news is that India is back to positive year-on-year growth and stronger recovery, will hopefully come in the years going forward. Again, if there's no big second serious wave in terms of COVID cases, and please in terms of the hit on economic activity.
On economic growth, there is a second wave right now. One can just hope that it gets better soon. Now, you've written, and I quote, "Our estimate suggests last year's severe collapse could have been at least three times as large had it not been for the swift policy support worldwide." Does this, however, mean that several countries, including India, have a higher debt burden and fewer policy options which are available?
Countries had to provide the kind of support that they did. I think this was essential to put a floor on the collapse. The global growth shrunk, according to our estimate, by negative 3.3%. If the support hadn't come through, it would have fallen by minus 9% or more. So I think this was essential. So yes, countries are, at this point with higher levels of debt. But of course, an important thing to keep in mind is while debt levels are high, debt servicing costs are actually very measurable for many, many countries because interest rates are still quite low. Now, again, I think what is required is that, it's important for countries to have medium-term fiscal frameworks, credible frameworks, so that you know that once the pandemic is over and you're exiting this, there's a credible way to bring down the deficit and to reduce your debt. And that will help countries now because it will keep your borrowing costs low and you don't have to worry about, what they call rollover risks. So actions are needed, but right now we still are asking policymakers to provide essential support.
Now, the report says, and I quote, "Because the crisis has accelerated the transformative forces of digitalization and automation, many of the jobs lost are unlikely to return, requiring worker reallocation across sectors. Will digitization end up meaning millions of jobs will be lost?"
So again, this is a twin-edged sword. You have digitalization, which has a positive of raising productivity in countries and therefore raising incomes for several people. But as we've known from the past, that when you have digitalization and when you have automation, you end up with hollowing out of jobs for some kinds of skilled workers, low-skilled workers. And so again, this, the COVID crisis has accelerated that shift towards automation. And therefore, I think it's very important for, to put in place policies that help with retraining and reskilling of workers, to kind of reallocate workers from sectors that will shrink to sectors that will grow. Now, this is not easy. It's easier said than done. But again, this was what will be required. You can also think in some countries, very targeted hiring subsidies can also be provided to bring back more of the workforce. So kind of all of these measures will be needed.
Now, the report says resources will need to be devoted to reverse learning losses among children who lost instructional time during the pandemic, for instance, through increased spending on education. This is just so important. It's critical. How important is this now in terms of policy measures directed at education if we are looking at future global economic growth?
Well, this is absolutely essential. The hit to children's education is really, I mean, I would say awful. It's really bad. Again, when I mentioned this piece about doing more on this front in terms of the budget, we can think of how you could add about 0.5% of GDP could be spent on revenue measures, that would be a combination of income transfers, but also spending on education to remedy this lost learning.
A final question, climate change. Now, you write, without global cooperation, climate change will continue to hamper economic growth and convergence, and that global emissions were about 4% lower in 2020. Do you believe that essentially all we've had in the last year was a breather, literally, as far as the environment was concerned?
Well, absolutely, yes. This is highly transitory. This is not going to, we might get some bit of lower emissions because people are not flying as much, but it's negligible. This is not going to do it. There's a need for a much more investment, green infrastructure investment. The IEA says that number should be around $600 billion a year for a decade, coming both from the public and the private sector. That's a large amount of money. Of course, this is for the world as a whole. And then the second, of course, is carbon pricing, which is also important to incentivize the shift away from so much of energy consumption. Both of these are needed to be on kind of any credible path towards keeping the planet safe.
All right, Geeta Gopinath listing several concerns at the moment. We are still very much in a difficult spot in terms of the global economy, but there is perhaps hope at the end of the day, so closely associated with vaccination and with healthcare. Always a privilege speaking to you. Wonderful once again. Thank you, Geeta Gopinath, very much for being with us.
Thank you, Vishnu.